So, Per, first things first, how are you?
I'm good. It's great being here.
It's very good to hear. So, before we talk about kind of the music you've been making all this time and what you're working on now, I'd like to jump back to the beginning because I read somewhere that when you were quite young, you were already you described yourself as a music nerd. You were kind of looking for everything. So, when was the first time that you discovered music in a way, that you discovered melodies and that you had a...
Well, I had a brother who's unfortunately he's gone now, but he was 7 years older than me, and he was really a music lover, and he had a great record collection, and I always sneaked into his room and checked out his records, and so it's because of him very much that I started listening to music myself. My first memories of music is very much the mid '60s singles like "We Got to Get Out of This Place" by The Animals, or I love the guitar sound on "Dizzy Miss Lizzy." I don't know, there was something infectious about it. You know, I don't really know. Yeah. When I got older, I went back a little bit and asked the question: Why did I like that? I love "Dizzy Miss Lizzy," for instance, which was the flip side of "Yesterday." I hated "Yesterday," but I love "Dizzy Miss Lizzy." And why is that? You know, when you're 6, 7 years old, you just go by instinct. You don't really know what you're doing. You just, I love this, I hate this, you know. So it was just a fun thing. And it was just something that was, I loved the world of listening to music, and I loved the sounds, and I loved the, it was just something different to anything else. And I come from a family, my mother was very artistic. She was a painter and she did clay stuff, and you know, my sister as well. Mm. So to start writing and to start creating things came very easy to me. So I started writing and making up melodies in my head without even being able to play any instruments. So that's also, I guess, a talent or whatever you want to call it that I had early on.
What age was this when you started creating your own?
10, 12 maybe.
And so how long did it take for your skills, your musical skills, to catch up kind of with what you had in your mind?
Well, you know, I started collecting records early on, really, when I was in my younger teens. And I always was the one at school who had the most records. And I worked on weekdays delivering newspapers and stuff like that. And everything I earned, I spend on records. Two singles every week, because they were 5 crowns each and 10 crowns, you know, that was the amount of money that I made. So I had a great record collection, but I was also at the same time very shy, very introvert person, so I couldn't really see myself performing or anything. But I started writing, and I started sort of dreaming up things and creating things in my head. And when I was, I think 13, 14, I wrote, I got a guitar from my mother, and I started writing songs.
Okay.
And I learned to play Leonard Cohen tracks, you know, with the finger things. Mm. "Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye," and "Suzanne," all those, "Famous Blue Raincoat," all those songs. And then when the punk rock thing and the new wave thing happened in 76, 77, for me, it was a revelation, because it said that anyone could play. Even if you're not very good, you're able to play. You could put a band together and it sounds shit, but it doesn't matter. And if you look a couple of years earlier than the new wave movement, you had the progressive rock movement, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Genesis and Gentle Giant, all those kind of Focus here in Holland. You know, people, fantastic, John Ackerman and Thijs van Leer, all those fantastic players, which you couldn't compete with. But you know, so that was like a revelation when the new wave thing happened for me. So I started like a new wave band with a friend from school, and eventually, like 1.5 years after that, we got a recording deal. And another year after that, we had our first number one record.
You mentioned you didn't see yourself as a performer early on. What was it like the first couple of times going on stage?
Terrible. Oh, I hated it. You know, I felt like, you know what, in school I was always the one who had to sing like some Christmas chorals or stuff like that, because I could hold a note. But I hated it, and I was all red in the face, you know, really terrible. But I did it, and then in my band, the first band, I was basically picked as the singer because nobody else wanted to sing. It wasn't because of any quality or anything like that. It's just that and also, of course, since I was the main writer even then, I knew how I wanted my songs to sound, so I had to sing them. But I didn't know anything about, you know, finding the right key. If I wrote a song in D minor, it stayed in D minor, no matter how it sounded when I was singing, because I didn't know how to modulate things. You know, it was just like, you know, I don't know. Some songs are just sounds really weird if I listen to them today because of the key. Mm. Anyway, but you know, over the years, of course, you learn you find yourself that you enjoy it a lot. And nowadays, it's like it's a different thing. I take being on stage very seriously. I think it's something that is very special to meet the people that enjoy your music, and it's a very serious thing for me still.
And I think the important part of connecting with an audience then is the music. So what were you looking at, especially as kind of your career went on and you met Marie and kind of started to think about Roxette, and what were you looking for in the music in terms of, were you looking for big choruses, melodies? What were you trying to transfer to the audience in a way?
I think basically I wanted to write music that I listen to myself, you know. And like I said earlier on, I come from the 60s and the 70s tradition, and that's the legacy that I always try to bring on into my music. And as the decades have gone by, I suddenly feel very old-fashioned because nobody writes music like that anymore. It's a very special tradition that I didn't realize it was such a style thing. When I grew up, you know, my mother and father listened to Frank Sinatra or Cole Porter or George Gershwin or whatever, and that was also a specific style, you know. And now suddenly, the way how Paul McCartney writes songs or Paul Simon writes songs, it's also a specific style compared to Avicii or David Guetta. You know, it's very different. So when I started my first band or Roxette, we wanted to make the records that we wanted to buy ourselves, basically. And also you shouldn't forget that coming from Sweden, coming from a small country, the odds that you should have international success are so slim. So we didn't really believe that there was a chance at all. So we didn't really sort of, let's do something really commercial, you know. Let's do something that we like, because it won't happen anyway. We might as well enjoy ourselves, you know. That was the attitude. Mm.
And in Sweden, obviously, it did very well at the time. But then with the second album, Look Sharp, it kind of explodes. So mm. so. As a group, as a person, having this success in Sweden, but then all of a sudden it's international. Everybody wants something from you. What was that as an experience? How did you and Marie kind of navigate through that?
Well, I think it helped a lot that we had a couple of years, actually many years of experience in the music industry in Sweden before Roxette happened. I was 29 years old when we had our breakthrough. Marie was 30 years old, so and I started out when I was 19. So I think that helped a bit. We had our own business organization together already, you know, publishing and everything. So it wasn't like we never really felt like one-hit wonders, because we didn't really expect us to be any wonder at all. So it was just like, I don't know, I think every person who gets gratification or getting success raised to the game, so to speak. Mm. And that's exactly what we did. When Look Sharp sold like 10 million copies or so, and I started writing the next album, which was Joyride. Marie went away to do her Swedish solo album, so she worked with another producer and another partner. And I wrote Joyride, and I was just like on top of my game, because I knew that, hey, if we had this four fantastic smash hits from Look Sharp, and then It Must Have Been Love happened from Pretty Woman. Before Joyride, you know, I could basically do anything because people like what I like, you know. So I wrote all these songs on a high. I wrote Joyride and Spending My Time on the same day, for instance, which is, when I look back, it sounds impossible, but it is actually true.
What kind of mood or mindset do you have to be in to do that? To have just, how does a day look like that? What does it look like?
Well, it's a normal day, but it's just, like I said, you're on a high, you're on a roll. Because you're having so much success and you get so much, you know, love or what I want to call it from people and things work out for you and I think it's the best feeling there is. I mean, if you do something right and you just continue working, and that's also, if you look at the other side of it, if you don't succeed in what you do, it's very hard to know what to do next because you don't really know, this doesn't really work. Should I change? And how should I change? Because if I change too much, I leave out my ideals and my taste, whatever. Especially in this business, when you're not having success, you have all these record company people telling you, you should do this instead. You should work with that producer. You should do this.
Is it difficult then to say no, I'm going to just... Because I'm sure there's a lot of money involved in all kinds of stuff. And how do you keep your eyes on what you want to do?
It's a very good question. I think everyone makes mistakes. And I think in the end of the day, what really saved Roxette was that we stayed in Stockholm. Especially when we had lots of success in the States. The record company and management over there wanted us to move to LA or to New York or whatever. If we'd done that, Marie and I, we would have worked with American producers and American musicians, and we would have sounded like Richard Marx or Bon Jovi or someone else. We stayed in Stockholm working with our band and working with our own style, producing ourselves together with Clarence Overman. And I think that was the trick for us.
Well, I have one question. I don't know if it's a good question, but for Look Sharp and Joyride, is there, you mentioned the singles, but is there maybe a song on either of those albums that you thought was really good, but it never really got the traction or never really got picked up?
Well, you know, when we recorded Look Sharp, I thought it was like, for every song we started, we did like Paint was one of my favorite songs on that album. Sleeping Single, you know, when Marie started to sing Sleeping Single, I felt like this, hey, I've never been involved with anything as good as this. This is the best thing I've ever been involved with. It just sounded so fresh and she was singing it. And she, I think also from Marie's point of view, I think why she really wanted to be part of Roxette, for me it was easy because it was my songs. But what she got from me was the material to explore her voice. And she, when she did her solo albums and working with her Swedish material, it was a very different style, very low-key, more singer-songwriter thing. But in Roxette, she could sing. She suddenly got songs like Sleeping Single or Cry or Dressed for Success. I mean, Dressed for Success is a one-take vocal. It's amazing. I think it's on film as well. We have it on film somewhere. She was just amazing, and she never really sang anything like that.
Did that change your songwriting then? Did you...
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And you know, I started writing songs from her perspective. You know, sometimes when you write a love song, the way you choose your words could be very masculine or very feminine. And suddenly I knew that, hey, this is going to be sung by Marie, so... I have to do it a little differently, so it feels comfortable for her. And also, sometimes she told me that I can't sing this sentence. This sentence doesn't make sense to me. It's too, I don't know. It's not me. So I rewrote it, and I think that is one of the reasons why she didn't want to sing the look, because those verses are basically, guide lyrics. I wrote these lyrics like, walking like a man, hidden like a hammer, she's a juvenile scam, to remember the rhythm, you know, and then I kept it, because it's in some sort of I am a walrus style, it made sense, you know, if you wanted to. but it doesn't really sort of, no English person or American person could ever write lyrics like that. But I could because I'm Swedish.
That actually makes sense when you mention I Am the Walrus. Yeah. It's kind of, it makes sense.
I always blame John Lennon for so many things in my lyrics.
if there's one person to blame, why not him?
He's the one.
and so after the, I mean, Joyride was a great success as well. So after that period afterwards, and I've heard you talk about this because then we already talked about it a little bit, the kind of the movements within music, and then grunge came in.
Yeah.
So at that point, when you first heard those bands, Nirvana, what was your first thought?
I loved it. I really loved Nirvana, and I loved Oasis in England, and that is one. You know, we after all those years of touring and success with Joyride and Look Sharp, and we did this album called Tourism, which had one of our biggest songs, How Do You Do, on it. We went to Capri and recorded the Crash Boom Bang album, and it took forever, and it contains some of our best stuff, I think, but we had a playback for our record company, and they said they couldn't find the first single, you know, you can't hear the single, it's Tom Petty's song. anyway, so I went home and I wrote Sleeping in My Car, because I was really pissed off with them. So I wrote that in the same evening and recorded a demo the day afterwards. And that was very, for me, it was very much influenced by Oasis and the grunge thing, because it was kind of different from the traditional rock set. It was all live in the studio. Clarence, our producer, he hated this. He didn't really want to produce it, but he did anyway, because he felt it was so, you know, unnatural for Roxette to go in that direction, which for me it wasn't at all, because this is exactly how my previous Swedish new wave band sounded, you know, because that was like the power pop era. So Sleeping in My Car could have very much been made by my Swedish band 4 years earlier or 5 years earlier. So Sleeping in My Car was different.
Well, let me ask this then, because is it then difficult that people at that time have an idea of what Roxette is, and that when you do something different, even though it's very much you, that they can't see it or understand?
Well, that is always the tricky thing, you know. When it created a sound, some people want you to stick with the sound, and some people, like yourself, you want to move on. It's the same if you go to like artists like me or like you know, Elton John or Paul McCartney, no other comparisons. You go to a show of theirs and you want to hear your favorite songs. You don't want to hear his latest album, you know, because you haven't even heard it. You want to hear those fantastic 40 songs that he wrote earlier on in his life. And it's the same with when you create something. So many people want you to stick to that, but from an artistic point of view, it's a nightmare, because you don't want to repeat yourself. You want to move on, and I think from my point of view as a writer or making records, when I write this new song, it feels fresh to me, much fresher to me than it probably does for you. Because it's a new song, you know, but without knowing it, it still has my sort of trademark on it. The way I phrase things or the way I construct the chords or whatever. So it's, I feel like I move on all the time, but if I look back, like, what I did like a decade ago, I can see like, shit, it sounds sort of the same.
right. But then at the same time, I mean, this year is the 30th anniversary of the second album. So, I mean, what does that tell you about the music, that there are still people who daily listen to that music on a daily basis, who still come to the shows, who still... what does that tell you about that era of what your creativity?
Well, I think it's an honor, of course, and it's a big compliment. At the same time, I think it's the music industry and the society was so much different 30 years ago. I mean, today it's very much about streaming music, and which is a good thing in a way, because everything is available. But what you lose is the physical thing, the record sleeves, the artwork, the presentation of music. I always say to people, think about all those albums you grew up with, like Aladdin Sane or Sticky Fingers or Abbey Road, and think about them without the sleeves, you know? It's so hard to do it. It just becomes music, just becomes songs. And they're so glued together with the covers. And it's the same with the Look Sharp album with Roxette. It's so much, if you talk to all those people who still listen to those albums, they think about the videos, they think about the presentation, they think about, you know, Marie's hairdo. It's just like, it's a combination of, it's how pop music was presented to begin with, you know. Now it's different. Now it's a social media thing, it's a more marketing thing. But that's the way the society has gone. I always say that pop music's only purpose is to reflect society of today. And if you look at pop music from the 60s, it very much reflected how the 60s were, you know, how fashion, architecture, art, literature, film, movies, fashion and music were linked together much more than it is today.
Right.
And that's, today you have the pop music of today is very much created by on computers, written in a different style because you move patterns on a computer. You're not doing like smart chords on a guitar anymore. Right. You know, that's exactly how society has become. It's very efficient, and it's very easy to work in a formula because if it works, you do it similar.
I've talked about this with more people. I just wanted to see your take on it, but obviously there's the music and the business. Mm-hmm. So do you think the business has, at least in my opinion, the business is taking a larger and larger role in comparison to the music? How do you feel about the business side of those things?
Yeah, I think so too. I think the business business side has taken over, like in every art form, it has become like it's the same way. It's a changing world. You have the Netflix, you have the HBOs, and you have the Amazon, and you don't have any record stores anymore. And you know, it goes hand in hand with what happens in music as well. And but also, you know, I have a son who's 20 years old, and he has all these. I mean, he plays a little bit of guitar, but not really. You know, a little bit of piano, but not really. But he plays Counter-Strike 6 hours a day, and he's spending so much time with his computer, playing games with his friends all over the world, and sitting there and shouting in his microphone. And that's exactly how I did, but I did it with Dark Side of the Moon in my headphones. You know, it's a different generation, and a different way of dealing with things. So maybe it is as simple as that. Pop music or rock music doesn't mean that much to the new generation as it did for my generation.
Right.
I don't know.
But it's a very interesting take on it. I do want to mention Marie because I think in 2016 she kind of had to say, well, my body can't take this. Mm. And what was it for the both of you, just the two of you, to kind of know that was kind of the end of you being on stage together?
It was, of course, sad. At the same time, it was expected. I could tell on the last tour we did, the last shows we did were in South Africa. You could tell that Marie wasn't really comfortable doing this anymore. It was a struggle for her sometimes. So it didn't come out of the blue at all. But at the same time, of course, it's the end of our lives together as Roxette. I mean, it was impossible for her to continue. It's really sad, of course. But at the same time, I try to think positive. She got ill in 2002 and she managed to come back, and we had like five additional years on the road together doing three albums. And so that she's a very strong person, and yeah, what can I say?
And you both do your solo work now, and then can you see a way of you working together in or even just helping each other out with a song or in that way?
You mean in the future?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I will always be there for Marie if she needs any help. I don't know if she's gonna make any new records at all. It's but if you know, I'm there.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
Then I want to talk to you about your solo album, Small Town Talk.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was based on two albums that you had written in Swedish. So how did that come to be to make an English version out of it?
Well, you know, first of all, when Marie and we decided that we should stop Roxette, that was in the spring of 2016, I said to myself, I want to do something radically different from what I've done over the last years. So I decided to go to Nashville and to record with the Nashville musicians, which turned out to be a very personal album. My mother died, my sister died, and my brother died within a period of 3 years. And so I wrote a lot of songs about sort of, yeah, getting older, basically, and looking back and things.
Right.
So it was intended to be one album, but it was so much material, so I decided to divide them into two albums, two Swedish albums. And then I had such a great time in Nashville, and it turned out really special for me, and it's something I hadn't done before. So I decided to make it like an English version of these sessions. And then I tried to translate those lyrics into English, and I couldn't really do it because it was too close to me. So I took help from an American girl called Sharon Vaughan, who lives in Nashville. So she wrote six of the lyrics. And she's partly living in Stockholm, so she knows a little bit of Swedish, so she could almost partly understand what I was writing about in Swedish. And she did a great job, and that helped me a lot, you know. And then I toured with the Swedish version, the country albums, last summer, and I had partly a new band. So I brought that band into the studio in the last autumn to record three tracks with that band, because I wanted that band to be part of that record as well.
Right.
So it's a little mishmash of everything. It turned out to be Small Town Talk.
Very last question then. Is it saying that they're very personal? What is it like performing those songs?
It's great. It's the older you get, the more personal you want to be, I think. You know, for me, it's like that anyway. It's like... every time you sing songs like that, time stands still a bit, I consider myself really lucky because I've had three really successful careers, you know, my solo career in Swedish, and my Swedish band is always working very well in Sweden, and also Roxette. So I can do like different things all the time, which is especially when I did this tour last summer in Sweden. For the first time, I combined those three groups into the show. So I played material from all my three careers, both in English and in Swedish for the Swedish and the Scandinavian crowd, and that was very special, you know, because it's so different. Even it's got my trademarks on it, it's very different. And we have certain songs are like pedal steel and violin, and other songs are like Joyride or The Look. So it's very different, but it's great.
Per, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you.